This is lecture number 6 in Ancient Israel, Historicity of the Patriarchs, Part 2. Last time we were taking a look at a number of the incidents in the life of Abraham, I should say, and those he was associated with, and seeing that some of the things that he did in terms of his relationship with Hagar, which was, of course, was instigated by his wife Sarah, and the fact that Eliezer of Damascus was his heir until he had produced Ishmael, and the reluctance he had to act against Hagar and Ishmael, were rooted in the legal and social customs of his day. If we take another incident this morning from the life of Abraham, we again find that the biblical material offers very close parallel to the legal customs of the days of Abraham. In this case, we're looking in Genesis chapter 23 at the incident concerning the purchase of the cave of Machpelah as a burial place for his wife Sarah. Now, it mentions that when Abraham came to Hebron, he had been elsewhere. He got a message that Sarah had died. And he arrived at Hebron and began to mourn for her. Then in chapter 23 of Genesis, we read in verse 3, "Then Abraham stood up from before his dad and spoke to the sons of Heth." Now, right away, we have a piece of very important information. It mentions that the people who were living here at Kiriat Arba, or Hebron, the two names are synonymous, are the sons of Heth. Now, ethnically speaking, we're talking about Hittites, the ancient people known as the Hittites. Now, the Hittites are not one of the peoples who were indigenous to Canaan in this period. They are a foreign colony. The Hittite Empire was centered in central Turkey, what's now Turkey. We call it the region geographically Anatolia, and these days we would have called it Asia Minor. Asia Minor is the term used to describe that area in the ancient world. The people who were in Hebron, who were Hittites, were there for reasons of trade. It was a trading outpost of the Hittite Empire. But this is what we have to focus upon. The Bible tells us this for a specific reason, is that the practices of these people would not be the practices of either Canaan or of Abraham. Abraham, coming from northwest Mesopotamia, does not come from the area of the Hittite Empire, and Canaan is not part of the Hittite Empire. And so therefore, the practices that the Hittite community at Hebron are using have to be compared with the Hittite practices in Anatolia or Asia Minor, not with the customs of Mesopotamia, not with the customs of Canaan. And when we do this, we find that there are some very interesting parallels between what happens here with Abraham negotiating with Ephron the Hittite and what was normative for a Hittite land sale. For a land sale according to Hittite law. And I will bring those out, by the by. I would like to stop and just comment upon the negotiations that take place. It appears that Ephron is being very gracious. When you read the text, it appears that way. Because Abraham talks to the leading members of the community, the men that sit in the gate of the city. Now, it's general throughout the Middle East that these are the important people. They just don't sit there and idle away their time. They sit there because that's where legal matters are discussed. So they are the local elders of the town. They have to be present to ratify things of a legal nature. In verse 8, we find that Abraham speaks to these people and says, "If it is your wish that I bury my dead out of my sight, hear me and meet with Ephron, the son of Zohar, for me." In other words, be an intermediary between me and Ephron, that he may give me the cave of Machpelah, which he has, which is in the end of his field. Now, Abraham is not asking for it as a gift. He wants to buy it, but he just uses the term, give me, in the New King James. But notice the way the request is worded. The cave of Machpelah, which is in the end of his field. Now, notice what happens when Ephron comes on the scene. Verse 11. Ephron speaks, "No, my lord, hear me. I give you the field and the cave that is in it." Sounds very generous. He says, "I don't want you to buy it. I make it a gift to you." And not just the cave that's in the corner that you're asking about, the whole field. Sounds like a very generous man, right? Well, things are not always what they appear. In the Middle East, as in, I think, the Far East, it's considered very bad manners to get down to a matter of important business before a lot of preliminary sitting around and talking about non-consequential or inconsequential things. You just don't rush right to the main item. Now, in this particular incident, Abraham has a reason for skipping the pleasantries because he has a dead wife. She's been dead for several days. She's not been embalmed. There is an urgency in the matter. He needs to bury her. Second, we notice the offer of Ephron. It is not meant to be taken seriously that he's offering the field as a gift without price. It is considered indelicate to say, okay, I'll sell it to you for so much. I mean, that's just very coarse, very crude. Even today in the Middle East, on certain levels when negotiations for property are conducted, it's done with a great deal of protocol, ritual, which is culturally dictated. This hasn't changed much. What Ephron is conveying by his statement is, one, yes, I'm willing to sell it. But the other thing is interesting. Remember, Abraham asked for just the corner of the field that had the cave. Ephron is saying, in essence, no. If you want the corner of the field, you've got to buy the whole field. I won't just sell you the corner. That's what he's telling him. Now, you might say, oh, this guy is a real money grubber. Abraham has a very pressing need. He knows he's got Abraham over a barrel, so to speak. He doesn't have a whole lot of choice. Therefore, he's trying to extract more money from him by selling him the whole field instead of just the corner. Well, there's more to it than that, even, which is apparent when we become familiar with Hittite land-owning practices. And that is that if a man sells a corner of a field or a portion of a field, he does not relieve himself of the tax burden for that portion. He is still liable for the taxes on the portion he has sold. Also, in this community, as in the Hittite realm itself, each landowner was responsible for providing a certain amount of military service for the protection of the town. It was based on how much land he owned. So if he sold a portion of a field, he still did not reduce his commitment. Only if he sold the whole field does he absolve himself from the tax burden, and does he absolve himself from the military obligation based on the ownership of that field. Now, I think that Abraham asked for just the corner, not because he was a cheapskate and didn't want to have to pay too much for this burial cave and wanted to save some money. Abraham is not shown elsewhere as being so acutely conscious of being thrifty, in the sense of being tight that way. Also, he has a very pressing need that I'm sure would not have been the uppermost thought in his mind. So why is it that he is specifically asking for just the corner? Well, as we will find out later, in either the next lecture or the one thereafter, Abraham was deeply involved in business with people here at Hebron. He had some very close business connections. But yet, knowing he had been called to live a different way of life than these people, he was trying to avoid becoming entangled excessively in their system, in their social and political system. And so he was trying to use the law that they practiced to his advantage to avoid becoming excessively involved in having to supply soldiers for the defense of the town and so on, and to become too much involved with their affairs. By just buying the corner of the field, he would avoid that. This is why he's asking only for the corner. As I said, the text doesn't tell us that explicitly, but I think we can draw that as a logical conclusion since we know he was not a skinflint. And when we know the significance of buying a corner of a field as opposed to the whole field, it's a logical deduction. Now, notice how the price is introduced in this very offhanded way. Abraham hears the offer of the gift. He understands it for what it means. Yes, it means I'm willing to sell it to you. And he spoke to Ephron in the hearing of the people of the land, "If you will give it, please hear me. I will give you money for the field. Take it of me, and I will bury my dead." So Ephron replies, he says, "My lord, listen to me. The land, it's worth, I guess, 400 shekels. But what's 400 shekels between me and you? You know, why should we let money intrude on our relationship? You know, forget it. You know, just take it." You see how he introduces the price, you know, what he wants for the field? This sort of sideways sticking it in. Now, I'm no expert on this matter. I have read some material in the literature by those who at least claim to be experts, and they claim this was a horrendously high price for the field given the values of things in those days. But the guy was really trying to gouge Abraham because he had a pressing need. But notice, Abraham does something very uncharacteristic for the Middle East. What does he not do? He doesn't bargain. Again, I think we can understand the fact that he's not bargaining because he has a pressing need. He wants to get the thing accomplished. He doesn't want to, waste time. And, of course, as a wealthy man, all right, he knows he's being charged an exorbitant price, but, you know, he can afford it, and the need is great enough that he doesn't bother about it. And so immediately, when he hears this statement in verse 16, he weighs out the silver for Ephron, which he had named in the hearing of the sons of Heth. 400 shekels of silver, currency of the merchants. Now, some of this material is just generally typical of the Middle East, such as the offer to give the field rather than to outright saying, "I'll sell it to you." The way the price is introduced. This is typical of the Middle East generally. But there are a number of features here that are unique to Hittite land practices. One, I've already mentioned, the matter of the distinction between the corner of the field and the whole field, which explains why Abraham only wanted the corner and why Ephron wanted to get rid of the whole field, because of the military and tax burdens, the way they were assessed. The second thing is the use of this specific phrase, 400 shekels of silver, currency of the merchant, or I think the Old King James says, was it ready money? What does it say in the Old King James? Current money with the merchants. This is a phrase which appears over and over again in Hittite land documents involving the sale of land. That exact phrase is rendered just that way. So that seems to be something particularly typical of the Hittites. And then something which seems to make no sense at all why this would be preserved, but yet is vital. In verse 17, "The field of Hephron, which is in Machpelah, which was before Mamre, the field of the cave which was in it," now this is the interesting part, "all the trees that were in the field, that were within all the surrounding borders, were deeded to Abraham as a possession in the presence of the sons of Heth." What's this importance of mentioning trees? Abraham's not buying fruit trees and other kinds of trees. He's buying a cave. Why bring this into the subject and preserve it? And we now have, as I said, studied many Hittite land sale contracts. And we have come to understand that without the mention, the specific mention of the nature and number and location of the trees in the borders of the field and in the main part of the field, the land contract was not valid. This had been a Canaanite land contract that would not have had to be mentioned. This had been Mesopotamia, there would have been no need to mention the trees. It is only among the Hittites, apparently, that a land contract, in order to be valid, had to make mention specifically of the individual trees and their locations. And so it's very interesting that despite the claims of modern critical scholars of the late 19th century, that none of this stuff is historical. It's all legendary, made up of whole cloth, or based on the practices of later Israel, 1,000 years later, that this very simple transaction preserves within the text all these intricate little details reflecting accurately Hittite land sale practices. And remember, that's what makes it important, is because he's buying it from a Hittite. So you'd expect those customs to be brought in here and not somewhere else. So as I say, it's very interesting. It's still preserved in the text. And again, it reinforces our appreciation that this text contains authentic material. Okay, let's take a look at another incident. This is a... Yes.
What were the Hittites doing that time?
Okay, the Hittites were very active traders throughout the Middle East, and their presence in Canaan is explained by the fact that this is one of several of their trading colonies that they had established. And apparently when they moved into the area, there was no settlement in this place. Archaeologically, that seems to be well-founded. The settlement seems to date from this period. So they had no trouble in acquiring land there and settling upon it. And therefore, they were not maybe the only people living there. Abraham was not a Hittite. He lived there for a period of time. Others who were not Hittite might very well have been drawn to the place, but the Hittites were the ones who ran affairs according to their practices. All right. We can take a look at something which is, not a biggie. And I'm not going to be very dogmatic about the point of view I'm going to present to you. It's just when the biblical text contains a number of peculiar points that seem to defy explanation by conventional means, and one answer or one suggested solution resolves all of those points very neatly, it stands to reason it has a good chance of being the right answer. Because rather than having to search for a separate explanation to explain each peculiarity independently, if one explanation will explain them all, it has a greater chance of being correct. I'm talking about the peculiarities involved in the text in terms of our cultural understanding in the matter of Jacob and his relationship with his father-in-law Laban. We know that Jacob, in order to escape from Esau, gets approval from his father to go up to Haran to look for a wife. His mother, Rebekah, knows this would please Isaac, and so therefore it's time anyway that he gets a wife anyway, so she is sure that this will secure Isaac's blessing on the enterprise and the permission that is necessary for Jacob to leave. And so in chapter 28, in verse 5, we read that Isaac sent Jacob away. In other words, he didn't sneak off. He went to his father and said, I propose to do such and such. Do I have your consent? Do I have your blessing? Do I have the right to go? And Isaac said, sure. And he blessed him, and then he sent him away. Now, Jacob, I'm going to skip over the matter of the incident that happened at Bethel and come to the time when he actually meets Laban. Now remember, Laban is his mother's brother, his uncle. We find in chapter 29 that he comes and he meets Laban. Notice a few things that maybe individually don't look quite so peculiar, but in toto add up to something which is interesting. Verse 14 of chapter 29. What Laban says to Jacob when he meets him. Surely you are my bone and my flesh. Now, of course, that might be something you'd say when you see a relative that you've never seen before, your nephew, the son of your sister, you've never seen him before. He might just say it for that reason. But I'd like to pose the question, is there some other reason why he speaks of him in such terms? Jacob proposes to serve Laban for 7 years in order to marry Rachel. Of course, we know what happens. He ends up with Leah instead. Okay? He serves another 7 years then to acquire Leah as well. Even though he marries her first, his period of service really comes second. But he stays with Laban a total of 40 years. Total of 40 years. But he never establishes his own household. He always lives with Laban. Now, this is an oddity. If a man is living with his father and he marries, he doesn't set up his own household, not in this period of time. In later Israel, he did, but not in the patriarchal period. He continues to live with his father if he's in the same area. He lives with his father. He doesn't just move a few yards down and start his own establishment. But Laban is in charge, and Jacob continues to live with him for 40 years after marrying his daughter. This is peculiar. Second, we notice, although by itself this is maybe not reason for comment, but something that will become important later, is that when he marries Leah, Laban gives to Jacob not a maid, which would be understandable, but Laban gives one of his own personal serving maids to Jacob. This is the way it's expressed in the text. And he does the same thing when Rachel is married to Jacob. Then we come down to the time that Jacob is told by God to go back to Canaan. He explains what he's going to do to his wives. They agree. They feel that Laban has not been very generous with Jacob. He has deceived him many, many times. And therefore, they see no reason why they should stay. Notice where we come to this conversation between the wives and Jacob about the plan to leave. Notice what the wives say. What do you find that's interesting in it? It's in chapter 31, verse 14. Nothing strike you as interesting? Charles?
I don't think the daughters have a right to inheritance here because they are married.
Yeah, because where does the property pass to? From father to whom? Yeah. And in the beginning of chapter 31, it talks about Laban's sons, right? So it's kind of odd that they're talking about inheritance. Why? Well, that seems like an oddity there. Then, of course, we find something else, which is interesting. Going back to verse 25, it came to pass that when Rachel had borne Joseph, that Jacob said to Laban, "Send me away that I may go to my own place in my own country." Why does he have to ask permission from Laban to leave? This is an oddity. "Give me my wives and my children for whom I have served you." Well, didn't he earn those? Weren't those his wages? Didn't he say, "I will serve you 7 years and in place of wages, give me your daughter"? And then, of course, when he was deceived, he said, "Okay, I'll allow that. But now for the one I really wanted, I'll serve you another 7 years. That will be my wages." Well, aren't wages his property? Why does he say, "Give me my wives and my children for whom I have served you," if he's already earned them? It seems odd. Then we come to another oddity, that when the original negotiations about the marriage are entered into, Notice what Laban says back in chapter 29, verse 19, when he says, when Jacob makes the offer to serve 7 years for Rachel. Chapter 29, verse 19. Laban says, "It is better I give her to you than that I should give her to another man." Is it simply because there's a virtue in marrying your daughter to a near relative? Or is there something more behind Laban's words? And then we come to the fact that when the very fact that who's doing the negotiating over the marriage of Rachel? Laban, right? What relationship does Laban have to Rachel? He is her father. In this period, who carries out the negotiations for a marriage? Brother. Absence of brother. Okay. Finally, Jacob does leave. He gets the support of his wives, I should say. And so they decide to leave. But before we get to that, there's one more point I want to bring out. Chapter 31, verse 2. Jacob saw that the countenance of Laban, and indeed it was not favorable towards him as before. Wait a minute, run that by again. He looked at Laban, the way Laban was treating him, you know, and regarding him, and he says, he's not treating me like he used to before. He used to treat me really good, but now he's not treating me good. This is, you know, 40 years later. But wait a minute. He always had treated him good? Tricked him on which wife he was going to end up marrying? Changed his wages so many times, always trying to get the better of Jacob? He calls that good? Something's peculiar here. What does he mean when he says, Jacob saw the countenance of Laban, and indeed it was not favorable towards him as before? There must be something else behind those words. And then when they actually leave, how does he leave? Originally, remember in chapter 30, verse 25, or 26 rather, Jacob had gone to Laban and said, you know, please give me my wives, my children, I want to go home. And Laban had talked him out of it. But notice how he actually leaves here in chapter 31, verse 19. Laban had gone to shear his sheep. Verse 20. So Jacob stole away, unknown to Laban the Syrian, and that he did not tell him that he intended to flee. That's a peculiar way of leaving. Because in those days, it was like crossing the country in a wagon train if you left the east and went to the west coast. You didn't ever see these people again. You didn't expect to ever see them again when you left them behind. That's a strange way of leaving. What explains that? And then when Laban eventually goes after him, God, of course, intervenes and says to him, very plain terms, watch what you say to Jacob. I'm looking after him. You watch your words, because I'll hold you responsible for anything you say or do to Jacob. So Laban is kind of constrained in what he says to Jacob when he overtakes him in verse 25. But notice what Laban says to Jacob. Verse 26. What have you done that you have stolen away unknown to me, carrying my daughters away like captives taken with the sword? That's about what you'd expect a, quote, loving father to say. Under these circumstances, nothing strange may be there. Nothing strange in verse 27. Why did you flee away secretly and steal away from me and not tell me? I might have sent you away with joy and songs, with timbrel and harp. And you didn't even allow me to kiss my sons and my daughters. Now you've done foolishly in doing this. It's in my power to do you harm. Really it is. But the God of your father spoke to me last night and said, be careful that you speak to Jacob neither good nor bad. Now, he raises the matter of the theft of his gods. Okay? But he also makes some other claims against Jacob that seem very strange under the circumstances. What is it that seems strange in the claims he makes? And if we take a look, and after the matter of the gods is taken care of, verse 43, Laban says to Jacob, these daughters are my daughters. Well, of course they are. These children are my children. Of course they are. They're his grandchildren. But then it gets peculiar. This flock that you took away with you is my flock. Everything that you see is mine. This is very strange indeed. If you pay somebody wages because he works for you, who owns the wages? Whether they're goods or money. The person who is your laborer. Yet Laban claims, hey, I paid you this as wages, but it's mine. How dare you take away my property? Something does not compute. Something does not compute. Okay, let's take a look at this. And one more oddity, I think, I'll add to it, is that when they make their covenant, notice the demand that Jacob is made to accept from Laban concerning the daughters. Verse 50. If you afflict my daughters, that's not the key thing, but the next one is, if you take other wives besides my daughters, although no man is with us to judge, God is witness between you and me. He is making Jacob swear he will not marry any other women. Now again, why? What's this all got to do with anything? Okay, let's make a list of all these oddities. And then the subtly suggestive things. Oddities. One, Jacob lives in Haran for 40 years. And he obviously acquires significant amount of property in the form of animals. Yet he never sets up his own household. Oddity number two is that Jacob steals away from Laban. In other words, he leaves secretly. Oddity number three, his wives agreed to go since they see no inheritance in their father's house for them. Now I say that's an oddity because at the time they make that statement they have brothers who are mentioned in the same chapter. Why would they expect an inheritance in those circumstances? That's odd. Another oddity, Jacob's statement, Laban's countenance is not favorable towards me. As before. It's hard to imagine when Laban was ever favorable, given their relationship. So that's an odd statement. Then we have the oddity that Laban negotiates for the marriage of Rachel and Leah to Jacob. Not their brother. And then we have the oddity of Laban claiming ownership of all Jacob's property, which Laban paid Jacob as wages. And then the final oddity that I wish to draw out at this time, which is the restriction on Jacob concerning marriage to other women. I'm not going to write the rest of it. Concerning marriage to other women. Then we have some suggestive things in the text. The way Laban greeted Jacob so enthusiastically. Bone of my bone, flesh of my flesh. Oh, you want to marry Rachel? Oh, great. Better I should give her to you than to some other man. Which by themselves don't mean anything. But in the context of these oddities, they do take on a new added suggestiveness as to how they might contribute to the solution. And then finally, the comment, or not the comment, the action of Laban, that when each of his daughters marries, he gives each daughter one of his own handmaids. Not one of theirs, one of his. Presumably, they took with them into the marriage their own personal handmaidens that were slaves. But in addition, Laban gives one of his own to each of his daughters. This is a suggestive point. Okay. I imagine we could find an explanation for, if not every single one of these oddities, for almost all of them. But they'd be separate ones each time. There is one thing which, if it's true, would answer all the oddities. And that is, Jacob was not just Laban's son-in-law. But Jacob became his adopted son. But Jacob became the adoptive son of Laban. Now, what is it that suggests this? When a person was childless and they had to appoint an heir, we've already looked at that custom. They took a slave born in the household and designated that slave as the heir. That's what Abraham had done with Eliezer of Damascus. But here you don't have a situation where the man is childless. He has daughters. But there was another custom of the area and period, which was this. That if a man had a daughter or daughters and no sons, he would take his son-in-law or one of his sons-in-law and adopt him as a son, making him the heir of his property. And thereby, in a sense, the property is almost coming to the daughters and through them to the adoptive son, you see. This is the way it worked. But there were certain procedures involved. Number one, there was a restriction that a man who entered into such an arrangement where he became both adopted son and son-in-law was bound not to marry any woman outside the household. See why that other little suggestive thing becomes more meaningful if we approach it from this way. But that was a restriction that if you're going to become an heir to a man's property by marrying his daughter, he wants to ensure that that inheritance will go to the children of that union, his physical grandchildren, that you won't marry other women, and then if his daughter dies, disinherit her children and give you the inheritance, you know, to the children of some other woman. Because you're not related, you know, that closely to him. And if you marry a woman outside the family who's not related at all, you know, the inheritance goes completely outside the family. The whole purpose for this thing is to keep the inheritance inside the bloodline and not have it go into another family totally. This is the reason for the practice. And so this was the common restriction that when a man entered into this relationship, and usually he was not a blood relative. It wasn't usually a nephew or some other relative. It was just whoever happened to marry the daughter. He bound himself to become a member of this family and not to introduce other people into the family by marrying other women. But, obviously, to Laban it made more sense, if he was going to adopt somebody as a son who became his son-in-law, to do it to somebody who was related by blood. So that, again, would seem to explain the suggestive points when he says, oh, bone of my bone, flesh of my flesh. Here I've been meditating on my problem. No sons, only daughters. I'm going to have to adopt somebody who becomes my son-in-law. Oh, I hate to do that, but that's the only way, I guess. And here pops up somebody who's related by blood. That's better. Far better I should give her to you than to some other man. Far better I make you my son than somebody else, because at least there's a claim of blood. Now, what about the sons that are mentioned later? Well, you notice that's when they are mentioned, later. There is no mention of them at all in the chapters dealing with the initial contact. And most biblical scholars, I wouldn't say all, are convinced by this omission in the earlier chapters and the introduction of the sons only later, that when Laban met Jacob, at that point he had yet no son. And that's what induced him to make the offer to Jacob. That would explain the comment of the daughters later. We have no inheritance in our father's house. You know, we were the heiresses, and you, Jacob, as our husband, and now adoptive brother, were the heir. But he had sons later. We've been put out in the cold. We cannot expect to inherit the bulk of our father's property any longer. They will naturally go to the sons that came later. This explains this otherwise inexplicable comment. How could they ever have expected inheritance if they had been sons when Jacob first showed up? They couldn't have. But if there were no sons when Jacob first showed up, they were the designated heirs, in the sense that whoever they married would become the adoptive son. And for a while after the marriage, there were no sons. And then, of course, sons were born, therefore putting Jacob out in the cold, so to speak. Now, why did God work it out this way? Well, I think it's interesting. By working it out this way, withholding sons from Laban, it certainly induced Laban to make this deal with Jacob. And it was God's purpose that Jacob marry these women. It was also God's purpose that Jacob acquire a certain amount of wealth in this fashion, which he did through his wages. But it was not God's purpose that Jacob stay here forever. Remember, when Jacob left from his home, he was the owner of the birthright and the blessing, right? But Jacob, being Jacob, probably never figured he would really live to acquire it. He had the right, but there was Esau to challenge him forcefully, if need be, for it, who felt he had been cheated. Notice the wording of what Jacob says to God when he's leaving the land at that night of where he had a vision of the ladder with the angels at Bethel. It's very interesting what he says. Chapter 28, verse 20, he says, Jacob made a vow saying, if God will be with me and keep me in the way I'm going and give me bread to eat and clothing to put on, so that I can come back to my father's house in peace, then the Eternal shall be my God. Not exactly an acceptance of God as his God, and I trust you to work things out. No, but take care of me, then I'll let you be my God approach. You see, prove that you can take care of me, and then I'm willing to be under your rule. And notice what he says in verse 22. And then I will surely give a tenth to you. I'll even tithe if you show that you be with me and bless me. Then I'll be willing to tithe. But prove it first, then I'll tithe. Backwards reasoning, see. This is Jacob. He goes up. He doesn't expect much in Haran. He runs into Rachel, falls in love with her, finds out she's from his own, you know, extended family, and he finds out the situation with Laban. He doesn't have a son. He can become the heir of Laban. Who has to worry about going back? This is great. And then, of course, the whole thing turns around because Laban later has sons, which, of course, is what God wanted, because he didn't want Jacob to stay there for a lot of reasons. It also explains why he never established his own household. A son does not. As long as he's in the geographic proximity of his father and his father is alive, he lives with his father. He does not set up his own household. This is normative. He steals away from Laban. Why? Because you notice when he wanted to leave before, what does it say in the text? He went to Laban and he said, give me my wives and my children. and let me go. Why? Because you notice when he wanted to leave before, what does it say in the text? He went to Laban and he said, give me my wives and my children, and let me go back home. That's what a son has to do. A son just can't pick up and leave. Remember when he left from Isaac? He went to him and he said, I'd like to go up to Haran and get a wife from, you know, your extended family relations. And Isaac said, fine, you can go. You don't leave without parental permission. It's not allowed. A son-in-law does not need that. A son does. Then Laban's statement, everything you see is mine. Legally, it was. Any wages or property given by a father to a son is still the property of the father, legally, until his death. He has the legal claim on it, but not over a son-in-law. Again, reinforcing that Jacob's position to Laban was as a son. Jacob's comment, Laban's countenance is not favorable towards me as it was before. Well, he's not talking about the time when he was working for the wages, which got changed all the time. He's not talking about being the time when he was cheated, you know, and the wives. He's talking about the initial contract. I was the designated heir. He really looked upon me, my heir. But I'm no longer his heir. He doesn't treat me like one. So what have I got to lose if I leave? This is what he means. Now, any marriage could be barren. Sarah's was for so long. Rebecca's was for a long period of time. It's interesting, the Bible doesn't dwell on it. It says Rebecca was barren, and Isaac entreated the God for her, and she bore the children. Oh, yeah. He prayed for a week, a month, got children. You take the year of Isaac's age, rather, when he married, and the year when he had his children, you see, I think it's something like 25 years. This wasn't a short period of time, you see, before that miracle happened. Barrenness was not unknown. But in this relationship, a man who enters into this kind of relationship is bound not to marry women outside the household. But what if he can't have children by these women? That's where those handmaids came in. By being the handmaid of Laban, they were still accounted part of the family. Remember, in our way of thinking, servants are not family. But in this way of thinking, servants are family, and sometimes closer family than a blood relative. Remember, Eliezer of Damascus was Abraham's heir because he was close family, closer than Lot, by their ways of thinking. And that's the purpose behind these handmaids. And it was the way it was done to provide against the chance of future barrenness in the daughters, was to provide a handmaid of the adopted father to his adoptive son, to be used in that way. And both of them ended up being used that way. Because first Rachel was barren totally, and then later Leah became barren, and so he had children of the handmaids as well as of the two women. And so all of these things are neatly explained, all the oddities, and even the suggestive little things acquire additional meaning if you take this one assertion that Jacob became an adoptive son and not just a son-in-law. As I say, I'm not going to be dogmatic and say it has to be the way it was, but it seems like a very particularly neat solution answering all the oddities with one explanation.